It must be noted that the war against Iraq is now being used as a precedent for further police actions under the authority of the United Nations. World government tyranny is a few steps nearer, its way being prepared by President Bush's New World Order. Nations who appear to threaten Jewish international financial interests and or the State of Israel can expect to find themselves burned to smithereens. The Jewish-controlled mass media will, of course, be relied upon to justify all such actions as being in British interests, or in France, in French interests, in the United States, in America's interests, etc., etc., and to whip up the ignorant game into paroxysm of flag-waving patriotism. How the elders of Zion must be laughing at us. It was stated a few moments ago that nations who appear to threaten Jewish international financial interests and or the State of Israel can expect to find themselves bombed smithereens. To a slightly lesser degree, certain individuals, groups of people or organizations who pose a similar threat or are a threat to the establishment or step out of line with the ones who control the establishment can expect to be A, undermined or ridiculed by the controlled media, or removed in some way. This was pointed out quite rightly by David Icke in his book, The Robots' Rebellion. It was also explained how, through the control of money, peoples and nations can be manipulated without them being aware of it. When did you last see an in-depth debate on the world, nay, even the nation's monetary system? When did you last read about some MP putting forward a motion along similar lines? At this juncture, I would like to read a couple of extracts from a small pamphlet, which runs Monetary Reform. The nation's monetary system must be taken out of the hands of the private banking interests and made a national resource to be controlled according to national needs. And later on, our solution to this constant problem of interest rates and inflation is to rule that private banks will no longer be permitted to lend money in excess of real cash reserves. The creation of all new money must become the sole prerogative of government and must occur in a manner that renders the new money debt-free and, as stated earlier, issued in a quantity equated to the expansion of real national wealth. This money should regularly be created as a portion of public expenditure, thus making possible a vast reduction of taxation without necessitating public cuts. At the same time, it will enable wages to be regularly increased as production increases without any inflationary results. The two paragraphs that I just read were extracts from a small pamphlet which belongs to a number of very small parties who always get a very hostile press. Indeed, if the editor of any national newspaper were to publish what I have just stated, he will be sacked. Just as a matter of interest, that was part of the election manifesto of the British National Party. If you recall, the initial theme of this talk was brainwashing and its insidious powers on the human race. I will now extend upon this theme on a most controversial subject. Winston Churchill identified Jewish leaders as the driving power behind communism in an article entitled Zionism versus Bolshevism, The Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, published in the Illustrated Sunday Herald, London, in 1920. As we have seen, the Jewish leaders of communism have been behind the torture and deaths of hundreds of millions of anti-communists and Christian people. Yet, because of the unremitting outpouring of Jewish propaganda from the Jewish-controlled press and broadcasting media, the average person in the West, if asked to name the worst atrocity of the 20th century, would, in a preconditioned reaction reminiscent of a Pavlovian dog, declare the Holocaust, the systematic extermination of 6 million Jews in the gas chambers of German Nazi concentration camps during the Second World War. Whilst it cannot be denied that there were massacres of Jews by German Nazis and their allies during World War II, often in revenge for the ghastly activities of the Jewish-led communist secret police, then known as the NKVD or the Czechists. The total of such Jewish deaths can be computed in the hundreds of thousands, not millions, as claimed in the Holocaust legend. The news films of emaciated Jews in newly liberated German concentration camps like Belsen and Dachau, though horrific to see, are not evidence of systematic extermination, but of famine and typhus, phenomena which affected the whole of Germany and other parts of Europe at the end of the war due to the massive extent of Allied bombing. More than 2 million German civilians died of famine and typhus during the years 1944 to 1947. That figure does not include the number of German civilians killed by bombing. As many as 300,000 civilians died in just 3 nights in the 1944 raids on Dresden, a non-military target crammed with refugees fleeing from the Russians. Those who have studied in depth Holocaust propaganda over the years have long realized that the Jews, of both the communist and Zionist variety, have grotesquely exaggerated and in many cases invented stories of Jewish suffering and extermination. Any investigative journalist need only examine pre-war Jewish sources on world Jewish population totals and compare those figures with post-war world Jewish population totals to realize that world Jewry could not possibly have maintained, indeed slightly increased, its total population during the Second World War and also have lost 6 million in the Holocaust. Those who promote the Holocaust legend point to the relatively small post-war Jewish populations of Germany, Austria, Hungary, and other parts of Europe compared with the pre-war Jewish population figures. In fact, of course, before the war started, hundreds of thousands of Jews left Central and Western Europe for the United States, Britain, Canada, and South America. Millions of Jews left eastern parts of Europe for the Soviet Union, where huge numbers were located east of the Urals for the duration of the war. The Zionists used, and still use, the Holocaust horror stories to bounce the world into accepting their conquest of the land of Palestine after World War II and other Arab territories since then. They also use the Holocaust as a way of raising vast sums of money, reparations from Germany, gifts from soft-hearted and gullible Gentiles elsewhere. The communist Jews play up to the Holocaust story because they hope to distract world attention from the true horrors perpetrated by them in the gulags of Siberia to false tales of German Nazi death camps. However, little by little, the Jewish Holocaust story is becoming increasingly threadbare as various eyewitness accounts and items of evidence become subject to critical and intelligent examination by independent-minded historians and scholars in a variety of other academic disciplines. The following examples illustrate this point. Firstly, many people think that the concentration camp at Dachau, Germany, was one of the legendary death camps which operated the gas chamber system for the systematic extermination of Jewish inmates. Immediately on the capture of Dachau by American troops, photographs were shown of the door of one such gas chamber. Senior German officers who had been in charge of the camp were put on trial, convicted and hanged for mass murder by use of gas chambers. Years later, it was admitted that the only gas chamber that existed at Dachau was a small, airtight room used for delousing clothes by means of hydrocyanic acid gas. This method of eliminating typhus-carrying lice was common throughout Europe at the time. This was the facility which was depicted in earlier propaganda photographs as being the gas chamber used for the mass murder of Jews, a crime which did not happen, but for which innocent men were hanged by Allied war crimes tribunals. Even Greville Janner, QC, MP, admitted in the House of Commons 10 years ago when he was chairman of the Board of Deputies of British Jews. As everyone knows, there were no gas chambers in Dachau. Secondly, many people will recollect seeing photographs of a medical kidney dish with white lumps in it, which were described as human soap. This was an official exhibit at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trial, designed to prove that the Nazis melted down the corpses of their Jewish victims to make soap. Since then, it has been admitted, even by Jewish Holocaust study centers, that no such human soap ever existed, and that this ludicrous Soviet exhibit, the authenticity of which went unchallenged by any of the Allied judges and prosecutors, was a propaganda hoax. Much the same process happened after the First World War, when horror stories about the Kaiser's tin human flesh factory and the German troops riding into Belgium with babies impaled on their lances, etc., were disproved, formally withdrawn and apologized for by the British government in 1925. No such apology would seem to be in prospect in respect of the Second World War Holocaust horror stories, even though 50 years have elapsed, because international Jewry is deriving such incredible benefits, political and financial, from instilling into the Gentile peoples of the world a massive guilt complex about the Holocaust. Jewry is well able to cow and brainwash large sections of the world's population because, through their control of the world banking system, they have been able to achieve a virtual monopoly control of the international mass media, press, television, films, book publishing, theatre, and so on. They use that media monopoly relentlessly to keep alive the Holocaust legend in the minds of gullible, brainwashed Gentiles, and thereby license themselves to perpetrate all manner of crimes, from squalid financial frauds, i.e. the Guinness scandal in Britain, to treason and subversion, i.e. the Pollard spy scandal in America, to international terrorism and genocidal warfare, i.e. the Israeli invasion of the Lebanon and occupation of the West Bank. It is because Jewry needs to have the propaganda weapon of the Holocaust legend that it not only keeps on pumping out propaganda extravaganzas on the television, but also bullies the politicians of nations throughout the world to mount war crimes trials against elderly men who have served with the German forces during the last war, and who since the war have tried to build new lives for themselves in Britain, the USA, Canada, Australia, and so on. Britain's legal system has recently, April 1991, been corrupted by the House of Commons, with stout resistance from the House of Lords, solely as a result of Jewish pressure to legislate retrospectively so that show trials can be mounted, which would serve as a focus for the Jewish-owned media to pump out yet more propaganda lies. However, the Jews do not have everything entirely their own way. Apart from the very brave resistance to the Jewish war crimes trial lobby by many members of the House of Lords, there has also been a recent appearance of an item of research entitled the Leichter Report, which has severely rattled the Jewish Holocaust industry. Several years ago, Jewish lobbyists in Canada persuaded the authorities to prosecute a German-Canadian, Ernst Zundel, for distributing the international bestseller Did 6 Million Really Die? By Richard Harwood. Charges were laid against Zundel under the terms of a law which prohibits spreading false rumors. This law was enacted during the First World War as a measure to hide from the civilian population the full extent of the horrors taking place at the battlefront. Zundel was convicted at the first trial, and on appeal, the trial judge was held to be so biased against the defendant that a new trial was ordered. The key defense witness at the second trial was Fred Leichter, head of the American engineering firm Fred Leichter Associates. This firm has been America's, and therefore probably the world's, leading specialist in the design, construction, and maintenance of execution gas chambers. Until recently, when American Jewish lobbyists intervened to try to destroy the firm, Fred Leichter Associates had contracts of many years' standing with several states of the United States, which still execute criminals convicted of capital crimes in gas chambers. Mr. Leichter and his firm have no political background or involvement whatsoever. Prior to Zundel's second trial, Leichter and a team of his firm's employees went to various of the so-called death camps, Auschwitz, Treblinka, etc., in order to examine the gas chambers and crematoria facilities to see if they were capable of executing and disposing of the remains of millions of people on the kind of factory mass production basis claimed by the Holocaust propagandists. At this point, it might be well to refresh our memories of what the promoters of the Holocaust legend claim. For it is only when we bear in mind the essential details of their account that we could appreciate the enormous importance of Leiser's evidence. They claim that many hundreds of Jews and others, but mostly Jews, were crammed naked into gas chambers. Once inside and the door shut, a quantity of Cyclone B, short pellets containing hydrocyanic acid, which gives off lethal cyanide gas when exposed to the air, was tipped inside through a roof hatch. After an hour or so, the door of the gas chamber would be opened and the bodies dragged out. The mouths and corpses were immediately searched for gold fillings and extractions performed. Other orifices were also searched for hidden valuables. This work was carried out by camp inmates under the immediate supervision of their SS guards. Neither the inmates nor the SS men wore any breathing apparatus or any kind of protective clothing. Indeed, the guards often callously smoked and ate during the gruesome process. Thereafter, the corpses would be sent to the crematoria, where they would be reduced to ashes in conventional coke-fired cremation ovens. On days that the ovens were too busy to cope with the workload, pits would be dug, corpses thrown in and incinerated. This process continued 24 hours a day for a period of years. In the case of Birkenau, in the Auschwitz complex of camps, this mass production method was supposed to have sustained an extermination incineration rate of 1,000 an hour, or 24,000 a day. Even before we turn to the detail of Leiser's evidence to the Canadian court, the preposterous impudence of the Jewish Holocaust story must be self-evident to those who can perform a little simple arithmetic. If Birkenau Auschwitz exterminated 1,000 Jews an hour for a year, that would result in 8,760,000 Jewish dead. Remember, 1,000 times 24 times 365. As that death factory was supposed to be functional for about 4 years, we arrived at a figure of 35,040,000. Suppose we allow for just a little Levantine exaggeration and cut the projected Birkenau-Auschwitz figure by 75%. That still leaves a total of 8,760,000. That number is nearly half the claimed Jewish population of the entire world in 1938. And let us not forget that gas chambers at other camps, Treblinka, Chelmno, Sobibor, etc., were also supposed to have accounted for millions of Jews. Fred Leiser explained to the court that the technology of execution gas chambers employing cyanide gas had been fully developed in the United States by the early 1920s. Literature concerning this technology circulated the globe thereafter, and all of the relevant technical information would have been available to the Germans. In particular, they would have been aware that, A, the cyanide gas is so dangerous that, if it is not to injure or kill those operating the gas chamber as well as the condemned person, the chamber must be specially constructed to be airtight and, specifically, the entry door must be gasketed. B. Cyanide gas is persistent. That is, it clings in corners and holes and in hair, in body folds and orifices for many hours after it has been released. Hence, after the condemned person has died, it is necessary to have a ventilation system which can expel as much of the gas as possible from the chamber to a height where the gas can diffuse in the air without posing any danger to persons in the vicinity. In the interest of safety, the body should be left in the ventilated chamber for 24 hours before the gasketed door is opened. Only staff wearing breathing apparatus and protective clothing should be in the room in which the gas chamber is situated when the door is opened. Thereafter, staff should hose down the body and the entire chamber to disperse the final, potentially fatal traces of the gas. C. Cyanide gas has been used by the German and French armies in World War I to delouse buildings and clothing. Both armies would post armed guards around, but a good distance away from the building being used for the purpose. After 24 hours, troops wearing breathing apparatus would open the doors and windows of the building, but retreat to a safe distance for a ventilation period of not less than 24 hours. Thereafter, clothing, blankets, carpets, etc., from the building will be put on lines and beaten by personnel wearing breathing apparatus to dispel the final traces of the gas. Cyanide gas is potentially explosive, and personnel connected with operations involving it will routinely search for matches and lighters before commencing any delousing operations. Reuter told the court that he and his team of experts had visited Birkenau, Auschwitz, and other alleged death camps in Poland, and had seen the buildings which are described as having been gas chambers, had taken samples from the walls of rooms said to have been gas chambers for later forensic analysis in the United States, had inspected the crematoria facilities, and had inspected other buildings in and the land surrounding the camps. He reported as follows. 1. None of the rooms said to have been gas chambers have gasketed doors or were in any other aspect of airtight construction. Had cyanide been released in any of the alleged gas chambers, the camp staff would themselves quickly have fallen victim to it. Indeed, at Auschwitz, the gas chamber was directly adjacent to the SS hospital. A channel ran between the two buildings, along which the gas would have accumulated, causing fatalities among the hospital patients, either by gassing or an explosion. 2. The rooms described as gas chambers were far too small to accommodate the hundreds of persons who were supposed to have been packed into them. Had it been possible to cram the rooms as claimed, the occupants would have died of asphyxiation. Even the doors were not gasketed long before the cyanide gas could have permeated the remaining space in the room not taken up by people. Had people been crammed in the rooms in the numbers claimed, and had the rooms been filled with cyanide gas, then the job of extracting the corpses without preliminary intensive ventilation would have led to the deaths of those performing the work and those supervising it. If there were no breathing apparatus, especially if searches of the corpses, orifices were conducted immediately on removal. 4. The crematoria at all campsites were of the conventional type, hired by Koch. Some cremation chambers could accommodate two corpses, mostly only one. Such retorts could only reduce cadavers to a few bones, which thereafter would have to be pulverized after a period of hours. None of the extermination sites had anything like the number of crematoria retorts capable of reducing to ashes the huge number of corpses which were allegedly being produced by the gas chambers. Each of the camps examined had a necessary number of crematoria retorts in relationship to the camp's populations and the likely death rate from all the usual natural causes, not including severe epidemics like typhus. 5. Any attempt to burn corpses in deep pits would be quite futile, as all of the camps examined were built on marshland, with a water table about 18 inches below the surface. Any hole deeper than that would quickly become a pond. Corpses cannot be burned underwater, even with the assistance of petrol. 6. Leuchter's team had not only taken samples from walls of alleged gas chambers that the camps visited, but also samples from rooms where all agree that clothes have been subjected to cyanide gas for delousing purposes. These samples have been given to a reputable firm of forensic scientists who regularly undertake work for American courts. They were not told where the samples had come from, nor the reason for the examination. They were merely asked to report on the content of cyanide in the various samples. The forensic scientist's report, in the form of a sworn affidavit, indicated that the content of cyanide in the samples which came from the walls of rooms used to delouse clothes was extremely high. But the samples taken from rooms where supposedly millions of people over a period of years have been gassed to death showed almost no cyanide content whatever. The very small amount of cyanide to register from the samples taken from the walls of the alleged gas chambers was due to the universally acknowledged fact that those rooms along with all other rooms in these camps, were periodically deloused by means of cyanide gas in an attempt to, eventually in vain, as we have discussed earlier, to protect the inmates from outbreaks of typhus. As a footnote to the twin subjects of the reputation of Auschwitz as an extermination camp and the fatalities caused by typhus, we might observe that the tragic Anne Frank, of Anne Frank's diary fame, was sent to Auschwitz after she and her family were captured by the Germans in Holland. If the Holocaust horror story accounts of Auschwitz are to be believed, Anne would have been an early candidate for the gas chamber, as she was too young and not strong enough to perform hard physical work. Yet, even as publishers' postscripts to her book, statements made by her father after the war, another member of the Legion of Survivors, and statements made by the Anne Frank Foundation readily concede Anne did not get gassed at Auschwitz. She did not even die in Auschwitz. For some reason, the cruel Third Reich, having built an extermination camp for just such hapless victims as she, and having sent her there at some expense by train, they added to it by keeping her alive and healthy, and then, unaccountably, went to the yet further expense of sending her on another train journey, this time to Germany, to Belsen, in fact, where, near the end of the war, along with so many of her fellow inmates, contracted typhus and died, with not a gas chamber in sight. There were no gas chambers in Belsen, as even Jewish propagandists admit nowadays. Anne's end was certainly tragic, but the events which immediately preceded it provide some additional perspectives by which one can judge the worth of the Holocaust fable. Reichter's revelations caused high anxiety amongst Jewish Holocaust propagandists, though they were quick to use their power to ensure that nowhere in the world did the mass media report any aspect of his evidence, and have now set about trying to destroy his company and his livelihood. But, despite their evil and subversive hounding of this honest and brave man, the truth about the Holocaust lie is leaking out. It is essential that it be exposed, for it is the greatest single propaganda weapon in Jewry's arsenal. This big lie, together with the monopoly control which Jewish bankers exert over the mass media, constitute the principal means whereby the majority of Gentiles is kept in a passive trance of guilt, fear, and ignorance. Throughout history, various nations which hospitably admitted an influx of Jews in the first instance eventually became aware that the Jews were ungrateful, Gentile-hating cuckoos in the national nest, and so expelled them. When King Edward I came to the throne of England, he soon became aware of the social and economic problems the Jewish community was causing as a result of their usury. Unlike other kings and national leaders then and now, Edward would not allow himself to be bribed by the Jews into protecting their money-lending activities. On the contrary, in 1275, he passed a law forbidding them from practicing usury. It is often claimed by Jewish propagandists that their ancestors only took up usury in olden times because they were forbidden to engage in any other trade or occupation. This was not the case in Edward's England. In his law, he declared that the Jews could only earn their living as merchants, farmers, craftsmen, or soldiers, the honest occupations followed by their Gentile fellow subjects. But the Jews were not happy with this law, so they secretly carried on with their usury and also engaged in coin clipping. They melted down the clippings from gold and silver coins of the realm and sold the bullion abroad, thus putting the economy of the nation in peril. The king finally lost patience, and in 1290 he promulgated the Statute of Jewry, in which all Jews were ordered out of the realm and forbidden ever to return. The king expelled the Jews because he was morally opposed to usury, as was the church at that time, and appalled by its social consequences, not because he was a Jew-hating bigot. He afforded the Jews the full protection of the law until they left his realm, and, indeed, he allowed them to take their possessions with them. During the period of the expulsion, one family of Jews had all their possessions stolen by a rascally sea captain who loaded his ship with the Jews' goods at Dover and then sailed off, leaving them on the dockside tearing their hair. The king sent his navy after the ship. It was apprehended, and the captain was hanged from his own yardarm. The Jews, with their possessions, were then given safe escort over to France. One other family of Jews was not treated so decently during the expulsion. It was offloaded, minus possessions, onto the Thames estuary mudbanks at low tide. All perished. It is noteworthy that while both these incidents are matters of historical record, a BBC Two TV documentary broadcast early in 1991 about the expulsion of Jews from England only thought it fit to mention the second incident and deliberately suppressed to mention the first, because it reflected well on the integrity of the man who delivered our land from the pestilence of Jewish usury and who was generally celebrated for his piety, valor, and sense of justice. This was the same documentary in which the sole comment on the usurious interest rates charged by Jewish bankers at the time, 2 pence in the shilling per week, was that such interest rates were usual. No cause and effect link was suggested in the program between such rapacious usury, the hatred for Jews which grew up among all classes of English people, and the expulsion of all Jews from our land. Any suggestion, needless to say, would have been anti-Semitism of the worst possible kind, deeply offensive, etc. Unfortunately for England and for Britain as a whole, the Jews were allowed to resettle in Britain by the dictator Oliver Cromwell. Cromwell needed money for his new model army, and the Jews were prepared to lend him all he needed in order to get a toehold in England once again. In correspondence between Cromwell and the leader of European Jewry at that time, Manasseh ben Israel, the proposition was canvassed by Cromwell that the Jews be allowed to have St. Paul's Cathedral in London, where Cromwell once stabled his cavalry horses, as their central synagogue. This unholy correspondence may still be examined at the British Museum. As Captain Ramsay, MP, made plain in his book, The Nameless War, Cromwell, as a commoner, had no authority to disregard the statute of Jewry. Indeed, the statute has never been lawfully revoked. Hence, all laws which Jewish members of Parliament have instigated, i.e. the Race Relations Act, since they were permitted to re-establish themselves, may be viewed as unlawful. In this context, it is noteworthy that over 200 years ago, in 1789, Benjamin Franklin made the following statement in the convention concerning Jewish immigration. Quote, "There is a great danger for the United States of America. This great danger is the Jew. Gentlemen, in every land which the Jews have settled, they have depressed the normal level and lowered the degree of commercial honesty. They have remained apart and unassimilated. They have created a state within a state, and when they are opposed, they attempt to strangle the nation financially, as in the case of Portugal and Spain. For more than 1,700 years, they have lamented their sorrowful fate, namely, that they were driven out of their motherland. But, gentlemen, if the civilized world today should give them back Palestine and their property, they would immediately find pressing reasons for not returning there. Why? Because they are vampires. They cannot live amongst themselves. They must live among Christians and others who do not belong to their race. If they are not excluded from the United States by the Constitution, within less than 100 years, they will stream into this country in such numbers, they will rule and destroy us and change our form of government, for which we Americans shed our blood and sacrifice life, property, and personal freedom. If the Jews are not excluded, within 200 years, our children will be working in the fields to feed the Jews, while they remain in the counting houses, gleefully rubbing their hands. I warn you, gentlemen, if you do not exclude the Jews forever, your children's children will curse you in their graves. Their ideas are not those of Americans, even when they have lived among us for 10 generations. The latter cannot change its spots.
The Jews are a danger to this land, and if they are allowed to enter, they will imperil our institutions. They should be excluded by the Constitution. Unquote. How prophetic that statement has turned out to be, and not only in the United States. It has already been stated that this lecture is not an invective against the Jewish race as a whole. Again, the average Jew is completely oblivious of their own history, apart from the one-sided version that has been inculcated into their hearts and minds by their elders and leaders throughout the centuries. It is only a very small proportion of their race, namely the Zionist and international Jew, who will do anything for Israel except live there, who are the implacable enemies of non-Jews, except, of course, the ones who dance to their tune, like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, and many other leaders who are no more than puppets. Behind such front organizations as the United Nations, NATO, and the World Health Organization, etc., and secret or semi-secret societies ranging from the Committee of 300, the Olympians, the Club of Rome, the Skull and Bones Society, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Committee, the Council for Foreign Relations, the Royal Institute on International Affairs at Chatham House, and numerous others, right down to the law orders of Freemasonry, about 300 individuals have led and are still leading the unwitting masses in virtually every country in the world into a trap that will be inescapable. That trap is a one-world dictatorship, which is sometimes euphemistically called the New World Order. Very briefly, here are a few of the policies, some of which have already been or are in the process of being implemented, that we can expect, unless we shake off our apathy, drag ourselves away from the bombardment of brainwashing, misinformation, and mind control that is constantly being rained on us through the Jewish-controlled media. Summarized, the intent and purpose of the Committee of 300 is to bring to pass the following conditions. A one-world government and one-unit monetary system under permanent, non-elected, hereditary oligarchists who self-select from among their numbers in the form of a feudal system, as it was in the Middle Ages. In this one-world entity, population will be limited by restrictions on the number of children allowed per family. 1 billion people who are useful to the ruling class in areas which will be strictly and clearly defined will remain as the total population of the world. The rest will be eliminated through diseases, wars, and famines. There will be no middle class, only rulers and servants. All laws will be uniform under a legal system of world courts practicing the same unified code of laws, backed up by a one-world government police force and a one-world unified military to enforce laws in all former countries where no national boundaries shall exist. The system will be on the basis of a welfare state. Those who are obedient and subservient to the one-world government will be rewarded with a means to live. Those who are rebellious will simply be starved to death or to be declared outlaws, thus a target for anyone who wishes to kill them. Privately owned firearms or weapons of any kind will be prohibited. To induce a state where there is no individual freedom or any concept of liberty surviving, there shall be no such thing as republicanism, sovereignty, or rights residing within the people. National pride and racial identity shall be stamped out, and in the transition phase, it shall be subject to the severest penalties to even mention one's racial origin. Each person shall be fully indoctrinated that he or she is a creature of the one-world government, with an identification number clearly marked on their person so as to be readily accessible, which identifying number shall be in the master file of the NATO computer in Brussels, Belgium, subject to instant retrieval by any agency of the one-world government at any time. The master files of the CIA, FBI, state and local police agencies, and Social Security shall be vastly expanded and form the basis of personal records of all individuals. Marriage shall be outlawed, and there shall be no family life as we know it. Children will be removed from their parents at an early age and brought up as wards of the state. State property, in fact. Such an experiment was carried out in East Germany under Erich Honecker, when children were taken away from their parents, considered by the state to be disloyal citizens. Women will be degraded through the continued process of women's liberation movements. Free sex shall be mandatory. Pornography shall be promoted and be compulsory showing in every school, classroom, theatre and cinema, including homosexual and lesbian pornography. The use of recreational drugs shall be compulsory, with each person allotted drug quotas which can be purchased at one world government stores throughout the world. Mind-controlled drugs will be expanded and usage become compulsory. Such mind-controlled drugs shall be given in food and under water supplies without the knowledge or consent of the people. Drug bars shall be set up, run by one world government employees, where the slave class shall be able to spend their free time. In this manner, the non-elite masses will be reduced to the level and behavior of controlled beasts, with no will of their own, and easily regimented and controlled. Just as a matter of interest, drug bars are already in existence and have been for some time in Amsterdam. Euthanasia for the terminally ill and the aged shall be compulsory. At least 4 billion useless eaters shall be eliminated by the year 2050 by means of limited wars and organized epidemics of fatal, rapid-acting diseases and starvation. From time to time, there shall be artificially contrived food and water shortages and medical care to remind the masses that their very existence depends on the goodwill of the Committee of 300. The United States and other white-populated countries will be flooded by peoples of an alien culture who will eventually overwhelm them. People with no concept of what the United States and other constitutions stands for, and who will, in consequence, do nothing to defend them, and in whose minds the concept of liberty and justice is so weak as to matter little. Food and shelter shall be their main concern. Just as a matter of interest, in Great Britain alone, we have an estimated Afro-Asian and half-caste population said to be as many as 12 million persons. No central bank, save the Bank of International Settlements and the World Bank, shall be allowed to operate. Private banks will be outlawed. Remuneration for work performed shall be under a uniform predetermined scale throughout the one world government. There shall be no wage dispute allowed, nor any diversion from the standard uniform pay scales laid down by the one world government. Those who break the law will be instantly executed. All information services, television, radio, print media, shall be under the control of the one world government. Regular brainwashing control measures shall be passed off as entertainment in the manner in which it is practiced and has become a fine art in the United States. Youths removed from disloyal parents shall receive special education designed to brutalize them. Youth of both sexes shall receive training to qualify as prison guards for the one world labor camp system. Lack of space prevents further coverage of this topic, I'm afraid. However, a comprehensive coverage can be found in Dr. John Coleman's The Conspirators' Hierarchy, the Committee of 300. The teeming millions who have died or been imprisoned in the name of religion or organizations with some high-sounding slogan will continue to blot our history books until the curse of ignorance is replaced by enlightenment. I might add at this stage that there is nothing wrong in being ignorant, but there is something wrong in the desire to remain ignorant. If you have listened carefully to this talk, you should be far more enlightened than what you were when you first began. This brings me to my final point. Most of the information given on these tapes would not be available through the mainstream media, and many of the books referred to cannot be obtained from public libraries in the United Kingdom or in high street bookshops. Nevertheless, this information needs to be networked in order to enlighten the masses as to what is happening under their very noses. The best and cheapest way to do this is to simply have copied one or more sets of these tapes, pass them on, and ask the recipients to do the same. Who knows, you might even get some powerful person or politician who will take up the gauntlet of what is truly a noble cause. Remember that all it takes for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. Peace to all who hear these words.